1996 Unstone Symposium presents session number 274, Homosexuality, A Psychiatrist's Response to LDS Social Services, a paper by Jeffrey R. Jensen, and The Biological Basis of Sexual Orientation, a paper by Warren C. Lathe, with comments by Rob Killian.
May I welcome you and begin our proceedings this afternoon. This is the time and place for session number 274, where we are going to be talking about homosexuality, a psychiatrist's response to LDS social services, and the biological basis of sexual orientation. We have a lot to cover this afternoon, and we're going to go ahead, even in the absence of our respondent who was flying in from Seattle, and I'm hoping we'll be here by the time he's supposed to respond. We're meeting today at an interesting place. We're meeting at the intersection of science and religion. Perhaps that's an overstatement. Intersections generally imply the crossing of two lines. I'm not sure that either science or religion is a line. But whatever it is, this crossing point is a dangerous place. It's a dangerous corner. And more than an intersection, it's sort of a gray area where things blend over, where there is perhaps a no man's zone. We not only have the overlap of science and religion, but we have the distinctions between the social sciences and medical or physical sciences. We have the blending of complex issues, and then we have a little bit of politics thrown in also. We have three presenters this afternoon whom I would like to introduce to you so you can get to know them in terms not only of their credentials, but as real people, as I know all three of them. But I will be telling you mostly about their backgrounds and their qualifications, and then you will get to hear from them individually. First, we have on my far left, and speaking first, will be Dr. Jeff Jensen, a medical doctor currently residing in Baltimore, but he was born and raised in Brigham City. Here in Utah. He attended BYU and went on a mission to Guatemala, graduated from the University of Utah Medical School, and then has more recently been in a residency in psychiatry at the prestigious Shepherd Pratt Hospital in Baltimore. And he is currently in private practice in psychiatry and is supervising residents at Shepherd Pratt. Next to Jeff at the table is Warren C. Lathe, the third, and he commonly goes by Trey rather than Warren. Trey was born and raised in Virginia, is a convert to Mormonism at the age of 18. He attended BYU, received a degree in zoology and humanities, interesting combination, in 1990, has been on a mission to Korea. He has a master's degree, an MS, in molecular biology from the University of Rochester, and he is currently in the very final stages of his PhD program in molecular biology at the University of Rochester and will be graduating this fall. Our respondent to these two papers, and as your program indicates, Jeff's paper will be the psychiatrist's response to LDS social services, and Trey's paper is on the biological basis of sexual orientation. Our respondent to both of these papers, and the one who is not here yet, and I have my fingers crossed that he will come dashing in momentarily, is Dr. Rob Killian, currently living in Tacoma. Rob is from the Seattle area originally, went to BYU, also a mission to Korea, a graduate of the University of Utah Medical School, and for the past 3 years has been doing a residency in family practice in Rochester, New York. He just finished that program this summer and moved back to his home area and is in private practice of Medicine with the emphasis in family practice in Tacoma. Just a word about our procedure. We will go in the order that I indicated across the table. Each of the presenters has about 30 minutes. Rob will have about 15 minutes for his comments. That should leave us 10 minutes or so for questions and comments from the audience. We will end the session promptly at 6:15 as far as a formal session. We're not obligated to get out of the room, however, because there isn't another session immediately on our heels. And so even though we terminate the session, those who would like to stay and discuss longer are certainly welcome to do so. So, Dr. Jensen.
I apologize that I'm going to need to read fast, and I also apologize that I'm going to be reading, but I don't do quite so well with spontaneous speaking. About a year and a half ago, I received a bootleg copy of the LDS Social Services document, Understanding and Helping Individuals with Homosexual Problems. I'll refer to it as the LDS SS document in this talk. I was intrigued and perplexed with the content and tone of the document. It is unusual as a scientific document written to mental health professionals in the 1990s for its unqualified and unjustified use of concepts steeped more in the prejudices of Western tradition, which date back to the turn of the century, than in modern social and psychological sciences. The document's title spells out its primary erroneous premise, that homosexuality is, in fact, a mental health problem. The LDSSS document's thesis is that homosexual orientation is a manifestation of a treatable disturbance in one's gender identity, which is caused by dysfunctional family relationships. Quote from the document, "It is in the three-way relationship between the parents and the child that the homosexual's family background is commonly dysfunctional. Homosexuality is, in part, a symptom of some type of relational deficit." End quote. This fallacy forms the scientific cornerstone of the LDSSS document, in spite of the numerous well-designed studies since the 1950s which disproved this myth. Even more concerning, however, is the way that the LDSSS document attempts to justify, if not require, unethical professional behavior on the part of LDS Social Services psychotherapists who are treating homosexual persons. How could the LDSSS document have been conceived, published, and distributed in 1995 by the Mental Health Division of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, an organization committed to the principles of honesty and integrity? I will return to this question later. Over the past year, I have engaged in a comprehensive review of the mental health literature on the subject of homosexuality. I reviewed literature in the fields of psychiatry, psychoanalysis, psychology, and the social sciences. I have also read publications from a marginalized group of counselors who have created a new field of Christian psychology, such as Nicolosi, Moberly, Dallas, Consiglio, and others. Counselors who base their psychology according to their interpretations of the Bible, a distinctly non-psychologic and non-scientific text. The results of my review are contained in an as-yet unpublished paper entitled Homosexuality, a Psychiatrist's Response to LDS Social Services. The time constraints prevent me from discussing even a tenth of the material in the paper, though I did bring a few extra copies if you'd be willing or interested in reading it. And I have a few copies over here to distribute after the session. Though the title of this paper indicates that my remarks will be directed to LDS Social Services leaders and providers, my comments are meant to reach a broader audience, addressing the myths contained in the LDSSS document, which are also widely accepted as facts by many uninformed people in Western cultures, particularly those from Judeo-Christian backgrounds such as ours. The question of pathology. History demonstrates that for psychoanalysis, the answer as to whether homosexual orientation is a form of mental illness preceded the question by decades. Psychoanalysts had been writing about homosexuals and their treatment efforts to eradicate homosexuality for over 50 years before researchers such as Kinsey, Hooker, and Ford and Beach began to ask whether homosexuality was a mental illness in the first place. The question was especially important because by the 1950s and the 1960s, analysts had linked homosexuality with severe mental illnesses such as schizophrenia, obsessional disorders, and severe character pathologies, disorders which simply are not present in the majority of homosexual people, but which have been used to buttress our society's anti-homosexual prejudices and discriminatory practices. A couple of points need to be made. One, psychoanalysis, a theory and technique-driven form of psychotherapy which originated with Sigmund Freud in the late 19th century, dominated early American psychiatry and psychology. Analytic theory has been the only source of psychological justification for labeling homosexuality as a mental illness. However, very few of the components of analytic theory have found support in objective scientific investigations. For example, penis envy and castration anxiety, concepts which were the starting place for the development of female psychology as well as male homosexuality, have found no support when studied using objective scientific methodology. Analytic concepts are interpretive principles more closely associated with the subjective disciplines of philosophy and literature than modern empirical scientific research. Due to its lack of scientific base, analysis has lost its authoritative influence in modern mental health. Two, since it was assumed that homosexuals were mentally ill, no openly homosexual persons were allowed to enter psychoanalytic training. Therefore, homosexual persons had no voice in the formulation of psychoanalytic theory. The evidence of this missing check and balance is clear as one reads the history of psychoanalytic writings on homosexuality. The writings are full of angry, hostile, sarcastic writings, descriptions of homosexual patients and their problems, with an intolerable number of cheap jokes at their patients' expense. Some analysts have gone so far as to justify and endorse violence against homosexual men and women. With homosexuals disenfranchised from psychoanalysis, psychoanalytic experts on homosexuality exercised tyrannical control over sexual patients and spurred hostile public opinion regarding homosexuality. Additionally, all of the psychoanalytic studies on homosexuality used patients who sought treatment for a variety of symptoms or who were brought to treatment in mental hospitals or prisons. These subjects already had evidence of poor adjustment irrespective of their sexual orientations. Before Evelyn Hooker began her investigations using non-patient groups of homosexuals in the 1950s, it had been assumed that the homosexuals in analytic treatment were representative of all homosexuals. Such gross overgeneralizations are misleading. An analogy would be going to a Ford dealership, noticing that all the cars on the lot are Fords, and then concluding that all cars are Fords. Selecting out of a population individuals who seem to share a common trait, and then stating that all members of the population also share that trait, is logically fallacious and yields meaningless and misleading data. Beginning in the 1940s, researchers finally began to question the psychoanalytic assumptions regarding homosexuality. Well-designed scientific studies emerged, studies which removed the researchers' biases from the assessment tools. Without the researchers distorting biases, the studies conclusively demonstrated that homosexuality was not associated with any mental illness. To be sure, there are some homosexuals who also suffer from some form of mental illness, just as there are some heterosexuals who also suffer from mental illness. But there is no objective evidence that links homosexuality to any mental disturbance any more than one can link heterosexual orientation to mental illness. Based on the numerous, well-designed, objective, and independently validated studies discounting the pathology position, combined with the absence of any scientifically sound evidence in favor of retaining homosexuality as a diagnosable mental illness, the American Psychiatric Association removed homosexuality from its official list of psychiatric disorders in 1973. All of the mental health professions subsequently followed suit, including the American Psychoanalytic Association, which has begun accepting openly homosexual men and women into its institutes. Gender, heterosexism, and sexism. Evelyn Hooker found that there is no psychopathology linked to homosexual orientation, and that in fact there is as much psychological diversity among homosexuals as there are among heterosexuals. Anyone like Hooker who has spent time with homosexual persons finds such observations self-evident. That in 1958, Hooker's findings came as a surprise to many in the mental health professions, reveals the extent to which That in 1958, Hooker's findings came as a surprise to many in the mental health professions, reveals the extent to which the mental health community relied on stereotypes to form their opinions rather than interpersonal engagement as peers outside of the consulting room. Recent studies have shown that only one-third of American adults personally know openly homosexual people. Studies have also found that lower degrees of anti-homosexual bias in people who know openly homosexual people on a personal basis. A Baltimore City Council person was recently condemning homosexuals on a radio talk show. A caller asked him if he personally knew any homosexuals, and the council person's response was an indignant, "No, I do not." The caller then invited the council person to meet and get to know him, his partner, and a group of his gay and lesbian friends. Since many of the things that the council person had said about homosexuals didn't apply to him or his friends at all. Much of the anti-homosexual rhetoric is produced by people who have no personal acquaintance with openly homosexual persons. Their rhetoric relies on stereotypes of homosexual persons. Stereotyping a group of people who seem to share a common, undesirable trait essentially reduces complex human beings into a caricature, which exaggerates perceived differences and minimizes similarities. William Green points out, "A society does not simply discover its others, it fabricates them. By selecting, isolating, and emphasizing an aspect of another people's life and making it symbolize their difference." End quote. Stereotyping is an essential feature of interpersonal and institutional discrimination and the basis of a society's prejudice. Fernald reviewed the mounting literature on heterosexism, a social psychology concept closely related to homophobia, which is composed of the related but independent dimensions of prejudice, stereotypes, and discrimination. In the language of social psychological behavior theory, heterosexist prejudice refers to negative attitudes toward, i.e., dislike of, lesbians and gay men. Heterosexist stereotypes are widely shared and socially sanctioned beliefs about gay men and lesbians that are used to justify anti-gay lesbian hostility. And heterosexist discrimination includes face-to-face overt behaviors that distance, avoid, exclude, or physically violate lesbians and gay men. Social psychology studies have shown that the factor most predictive of anti-gay lesbian bias is a rigid commitment to a traditional, Western culturally based male sex role, which is the basis of Western stereotypes of masculinity and femininity. Several studies conducted with heterosexual subjects have provided an image of the American heterosexist stereotype of a homosexual. Homosexual men were perceived as being stereotypically feminine, while homosexual women were perceived as being stereotypically masculine. Gay men were perceived as less aggressive, less strong, poorer leaders, more clothes conscious, more gentle, more passive, and more theatrical, as well as less calm, less dependable, less honest, and less religious than heterosexual men. Lesbians were perceived as more dominant, direct, forceful, strong, liberated, and non-conforming than heterosexual women who were perceived as more conservative and stable. To demonstrate the power of the stereotype, Wiesbach and Zagan presented a short interview, a video interview of a man, to two groups of heterosexual subjects. One group was told that the man in the video was homosexual. The subjects found the interviewee weaker, more feminine, more emotional, more submissive, and more conventional when he was labeled gay than when he was not. The perceptions of the man varied dramatically depending on whether the observer thought the man was gay or straight. Seeing the man through the filter of some preconceived stereotype influenced significantly the character traits ascribed to him by the research subjects. This is prejudice. Similarly, by officially presenting a derogatory stereotype of a homosexual man and woman and their dysfunctional families, the LDSSS document is contributing to the propagation of anti-homosexual prejudice among LDS social services mental health professionals who are ethically obligated by specific professional ethics guidelines to eliminate prejudice from their clinical work. We see another disturbing trend emerging through the social psychology studies. Heterosexist stereotypes rely on sexist stereotypes. Western sexist stereotypes of masculinity and femininity exaggerate cultural differences between men and women, exaggerations which bias the distribution of power toward men. The sexist feminine stereotype describes a woman as a follower, emotional, dependent, weak, submissive, passive, and creative, to name but a few. These are the same features attributed to gay men. The sexist masculine stereotype describes a man as a leader, strong, independent, aggressive, physical, less emotional, etc. These qualities are attributed to lesbians. Thus, anti-gay lesbian prejudice clearly is another expression of sexist prejudice. Fernald concludes, lesbians and gay men, by their very existence, challenge the sexist status quo. Because sexist ideology depends on exaggerating the differences between women and men and explaining gender differences as natural and immutable, gay men and lesbians threaten the foundation of sexism, whether consciously or not. Because interpersonal heterosexist attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors, coupled with institutional heterosexist rules and practices, reflect, create, and maintain male dominance, as well as heterosexual privilege, any strategies aimed at reducing or eliminating heterosexism must also be concerned with reducing or eliminating sexism. The LDSSS document, in addition to statements by various general authorities of the LDS Church, have made traditional Western culturally based gender role conformity a central tenet of their anti-homosexual rhetoric. In recent years, the LDS Church has moved away from its more blatant sexist positions, as demonstrated in changes in the temple endowment ritual, but still insists upon the sexist-based Western cultural conceptualizations of masculinity and femininity as universal and, sadly, eternal. It is upon those essentially sexist grounds that the LDSSS document and certain church leaders and members have focused their anti-lesbian gay rhetoric. That various elements of sexism are institutionalized in the LDS Church, as well as other organizations whose leadership and power are assigned based first on gender, is beyond speculation and speaks more to the historical social context during which such institutions arose than to purposeful discriminatory bias. However, that a social prejudice wasn't obvious at one point in time confers no authority to maintain it once it has been identified as such. The more appropriate role for LDS social services as the mental health branch of the LDS Church is persistent efforts at educating church members and leaders, local as well as general, as to the detrimental effects on individuals and the institution itself of perpetuating sexist and heterosexist stereotypes in the service of maintaining the illusion of social order based on heterosexual male rule. Sexual reorientation therapies. Psychotherapies attempting to change homosexual orientation to heterosexual orientation have been attempted for many years. Most sexual reorientation studies report less than 30% of homosexual subjects achieve a heterosexual outcome, and over half of those who experience some change in their sexual orientation were bisexual at the beginning of treatment. Anecdotes on sexual reorientation, particularly those published by the Christian reorientation therapists, such as Nicolosi, Moberly, and Dallas, are so heavily influenced by researchers' biases, flaws in design, sampling techniques, and outcome measurement that, according to Haldeman's comprehensive review of treatment outcomes, quote, no consistency emerges from the extant database, which suggests that sexual orientation is amenable to psychological intervention. In some people, homosexual behavior, like heterosexual behavior, can be restrained for periods of time, but there is no evidence that core sexual orientation can be modified through psychotherapeutic techniques. There are several other serious flaws with the sexual reorientation studies. None of the studies compared outcomes with control groups of subjects who accepted their homosexuality. Studies do exist, which have demonstrated more favorable therapeutic outcomes in homosexual people who successfully integrate their sexuality into their private and social identities. Additionally, not a single sexual reorientation study addressed the psychological or spiritual damage that occurs in the majority of subjects who fail to achieve a change in sexual orientation. Sexual reorientation therapies attempt to treat a disorder which doesn't exist, using unethical therapeutic techniques which don't work, while simply ignoring the damage they do to the majority of people who fail to change. People who are judged by the failing therapists to be resistant, morally corrupt, unrepentant, or simply weak. Why? In their review of statements on homosexuality made by various general authorities of the Church, Bingham and Potts approvingly noted, quote, the Church has supported efforts of the LDS social services and other consulting professionals to research the issues and to offer a reparative therapy approach which assumes that homosexual behavior can be changed, end quote. By the Church, I suspect that Bingham and Potts are referring to a small number of general church leaders who have been unusually outspoken in voicing their sexist and heterosexist biases as if they were doctrine, and perhaps worse, as if they were science. The Church, which has no authority in professional, scientific matters, has declared homosexuality a treatable mental illness and has required LDS social services to agree. Because such biases have been recognized as incompatible with the ethical practice of mental health, all of the mental health professions have included specific warnings against these biases in their ethics guidelines. In order for LDS social services to offer a reparative therapy approach which assumes that homosexual behavior can be changed, they had to leave the mainstream of the mental health professions and shop around for anyone whose own prejudices match those of the Church, no matter how unjustified, antiquated, unscientific, ineffective, harmful, and unethical their beliefs and practices may be. This unfortunate collusion has compromised the scientific integrity of LDS social services and, by extension, the LDS Church. A retreated, closed, propagandistic, and anxiety-maintained position, which is untenable for a people whose prominent motto is, "The glory of God is intelligence." We may ask, if a majority of people in a society agree that certain groups of people are undesirable, why should we fight against such an attitude? There are a number of reasons why we should fight against socially sanctioned hate and discrimination, not the least among them being the example of one Galilean Jew who dined with publicans, associated closely with women, defended and befriended prostitutes, and ministered to Samaritans. Hated, demeaned, subservient, or simply ignored outgroups of the culture of his day, for which he was derided and chastised even by his closest associates and disciples. It is he whom we recognize as the judge. It is his example we seek to emulate, including his manner of judging, or, as he has wisely commanded, not judging, withholding the impulse to judge and condemn one's fellow human beings, the remedy for prejudice and a corrective for pride. I make this point to demonstrate that the LDS Church or its members discriminating against any group of people according to stereotypes and prejudices is incompatible with core LDS beliefs. Indeed, we are obligated morally to weed out of society and the church lies which perpetuate attitudes and actions of hate. LDS social services should be at the forefront of this struggle, using insights gathered from the mental health and social sciences to help perfect the saints by eliminating such individually and collectively corrupting falsehoods, rather than distort knowledge and facts to justify oppressive standards and norms. There are several tasks which need to be accomplished by LDS social services. One, as a matter of personal and professional integrity, firmly commit to the principles of ethics established by the mental health professions to which LDS social services providers belong. Two, any mental health professional whose personal feelings or biases toward a patient or class of people cannot be contained is obligated ethically to seek out supervision or consultation or refrain from treating such people. Three, carefully read or read again the abundant scientific literature on homosexuality, even if it seems to contradict one's personal biases. Four, be willing to reevaluate one's own biases and prejudices. This is an opportunity for personal and professional growth. Five, as an obligation to one's society, use insights gained through one's professional and personal development to combat social prejudices and discrimination. Six, do not make the mistake of denying any church leader his humanity. Psychology has taught us that we all have conflicts, fears, and unfounded biases, conscious or otherwise, which influence our thoughts and behavior. It is not fair to church leaders to assume that they do not. They, too, are in need of growth experiences. Seven, refrain from using stereotypes in clinical and personal endeavors. Each personal and professional encounter with another human being is a chance to learn and share on equal grounds with someone as complex and deserving of respect as oneself. Emerson said, "The sign of a true scholar is that in every man there is something wherein I may learn of him. In that, I am his pupil." This humble approach to one's clinical work and interpersonal engagements can only better oneself as a clinician and as a human being. Eight, since only 1/3 of Americans know an openly homosexual man or woman, an important way to challenge one's own culturally sanctioned heterosexist prejudices is to associate with openly homosexual people on equal social footing rather than as a leader, a therapist, or otherwise social judge. Stereotypes lose their validity when confronted with the whole reality of another human being. This list of suggestions is a starting place. Prejudice, hate, and discrimination against people whom we don't know and don't understand prevents mutually beneficial interactions. There is much we can learn about our common humanity if we can get past the tendency to reject those who think, feel, love, or believe differently, or who come to represent aspects of ourselves which we may wish to banish. Christ taught that God is love. Let us recommit to honoring this principle in our personal and professional endeavors. Thank you.
have to say I noticed something and I have to point this out. This is indicative between the difference between a biologist and a psychologist. You know, I just run around from minute to minute not knowing what in the world I'm going to do the next second. And here's the, he has such everything all well prepared. I have to apologize at first. I've been spending a lot of time in my home state of Virginia, and when I get nervous, my drawl starts to really come out. I was told by my advisor a couple of years ago to get rid of my drawl because people won't believe my science if I speak like a southerner. Recently, as Jeff pointed out, LDS Social Services has put out a pamphlet that puts forth a very simple explanation for a very complex human behavior. It puts forth a dichotomy that is false. It puts forth a dichotomy that is an either or proposition. And a treatment based on a simple and false dichotomy. I've come here today because I'm concerned for three reasons for this. The first reason is I'm a believing convert to the Mormon Church and unrepentant in that. The second reason, sorry, I never get emotional yet. Second reason is I am a gay male who has gone through LDS Social Services therapy and knows the destructive and debilitating effect that can have on man's spirituality. And third, I am a molecular biologist who's concerned that LDS Social Services pamphlet's approach is both unprofessional and lacking in the understanding of even basic science. That's mainly what I'm going to talk to you today about, though, is as a molecular biologist and somebody who sees the world as a biologist, unfortunately at times. My point today, actually I want to make two points today. First is that modern research points to the fact, ignored by the social services pamphlet, that sexual orientation is biologically and genetically determined. The second point is, though, that what this means is not what most people believe it means. It is not a simple dichotomy of either or, nature or nurture. It is much more complex than that. Biology and human behavior can never, ever be reduced to an either or proposition. Let me explain to you first why modern research has come to accept, or most anyway, that sexual orientation, I speak of sexual orientation and not homosexuality or heterosexuality because it is a false dichotomy, and I'll explain that later. That modern research believes that it is genetically or biologically innate and determined. The first is theoretical. Theoretically, it is expected that it is so. Now let me walk you through a thought experiment. If you take a population of sexually reproducing organisms with two genders, and in the population all the individuals are ambisexual, a term I made up, they have no orientation whatsoever. Those individuals, only half of their matings will be successful. If in this population of individuals of ambisexual organisms, you introduce one individual that has a mutation that occurs that makes them oriented only to the opposite sex, every single one of that organism's matings will be successful. Over time, what happens in a population, a finite population of such organisms, is that organism's offspring will soon overtake the population and the entire population will be innately sexually oriented. Another thought in that same thought experiment is to take a population of environmentally determined individuals, where in some environments they are heterosexual, and in some environments they are homosexual. Again, you can introduce one single individual with one single mutation that makes them innately and irretrievably oriented to one gender, and sooner or later that population will be innately so, because almost all the matings will be successful and all its offspring will carry that gene. There's a basic mathematical population genetics model that every biology student learns or should. If you take a population and mathematically model it with, several versions of a gene, alleles, some of them, if they have offspring and 50%, the gene gives them the ability to have 50% male and 50% female, and some versions of that gene gives them 90% of their offspring will be female and 10% of their offspring will be male. What you end up with is that the alleles of those genes work themselves out through the time over population, that all, even though those different versions of the allele exist, the entire population will always end up as one half male and one half female. Now, the reason I bring this up, because it has nothing to do with sexual orientation. No matter what population you start out with, all the organisms, no matter where you start, end up to be innately sexually oriented. Now, once you have such innate genetic sexual orientation, there's several reasons that homosexuality or bisexuality or some combination thereof could be maintained. It is a simple fact. It could be that the mutation rate that makes a male oriented to a male is higher than the strength of the selection against it in the population, and thus maintaining it at a low percentage. It could be a polygenic trait, where there are many genes and many versions or alleles of those genes that affect the trait, and that most combinations of those are advantageous. But the rare combination causes an individual or several individuals to be homosexual or such, and that even though that might be considered a disadvantage, the advantages of most of the combinations are so overwhelming that it will still persist. A third is something called kin selection. It's a widely seen phenomenon in birds, insects, mammals, and many other organisms. It can sometimes be advantageous for some individuals for reproduction for either all or some of their lifetimes in order to assist their kin to do so. By helping their kin, either their siblings, parents, or cousins, to survive and reproduce, they are actually passing on their own genes because their kin are carrying the same genes they are, including the one that causes them to be non-reproducing, or homosexual in this case. There is a famous biologist who said once he would give his life for either two of his brothers or four of his cousins. It is probably most likely the case that all three of those reasons I just produced is the case. Now, what we see theoretically, is it true in nature? Well, yes, it is. The fact that sexual desire and orientation has a biological origin in gendered organisms is well substantiated in experiments, both physiological, genetic, and molecular. It has been found true in a disparate range of organisms, from flies to mice. Physiological differences in rats and flies and genetic evidence in flies has shown conclusively that sexual orientation is of biological origin. A recent study, inconclusive, in Drosophila, which is a fly that invades your bananas, shows that a misexpression of the specific gene, called here the white gene because it has other effects, causes male flies to mate with other male flies. The converse is true, that a full and, quote, normal expression of this gene causes innate sexual orientation. There is no doubt that sexual orientation in flies and other organisms is genetically determined and thus biological in its origins. This research in organisms and other animals suggests that what we expect theoretically is actually true in nature. Now, it does not always come true that what we see in animals is necessarily true in what we see the animal we call human. But there are two reasons why we might expect that to be true. One is if we expect it theoretically and then see it in other populations, we can reasonably expect to see it in humans. Secondly, if a trait is fundamental, it is expected to be shared among disparate groups of animals. Just let me give you a very basic explanation. There's a protein in all organisms called a histone protein. It's a very simple analogy here. But this protein basically binds up your chromosomes, the DNA, into chromosomes. It is fundamental and varies less than one-half of one-tenth of 1% between a yeast and a human. A trait that is fundamental is expected to be shared. A trait such as sexual orientation, which we theoretically believe to be fundamental, is expected to be shared. We are now seeing this in humans. There are physiological differences that recent research has been found, and let me just quote a very common one that many people quote, is LeVay's study of the anterior hypothalamus. It is important because, unlike some earlier studies, it looked at a part of the brain that was known to have a function. Thank you very much. In sexual desire. Also, the differences found in this region between the two groups of men is statistically extremely significant. The work is not without its weaknesses, of course. All homosexual men study died of AIDS. It could have had, though not been shown to, an effect on the brain's physiology. There are also some concern that it might not have been the physiological difference that was a cause of behavior, but the behavior that was caused of the physiological difference. I am not bringing these evidences up as proof. Science rarely works by proof. It works by a preponderance of the evidence in most times, as I have distressingly learned in my research. Secondly, twin studies. An early twin study in 1956 showed 100% concordance with the rate of identical twins and a 15% rate for fraternal twins in homosexuality. This study was admittedly extremely weak. But recent studies by Bailey et al. Suggest that indeed there is a correlation between homosexuality and relatedness. They found in 50% of all identical twins shared homosexuality. If they were fraternal, the percentage was much lower. If they were adopted, it was even lower than that, around 5%. Again, twin studies do not prove, but point to the idea that that homosexuality is biological in origin. Recent studies in genetic linkage in humans have shown even more conclusively at least for me as a molecular biologist, more conclusively that homosexuality is biological in origin, and sexuality in general. Hammer recently did a study that was reported in Science in 1993 that there was a linkage on the X chromosome for male sexual orientation. Further studies have shown the same in his lab for female sexual orientation. A recent paper in 1995 for Turner collaborated this evidence, and soon to be recent work in 1997, early 1997 by Hammer and others' labs will also show that there is a definite linkage for some individuals, a definite genetic origin for homosexuality. Now, what does this mean? I am, as a biologist, convinced that sexual orientation is of biological origin. But this is not what most people think in the popular image of biology or the public debate that's going on today. It is not an on-off, nature-nurture, gene-no-gene. Even if something is biological and genetic, it is never determined. Biologists who use all these big terms, genotype, phenotype, penetrance, over dominance, under dominance, pleiotropy, polygenic. Genetic makeup of human beings is never a simple on-off explanation. There are diseases that are always caused by a mutation in a gene. Yeah, but there's something called penetrance, and sometimes even the mutation does not penetrate to the phenotype or to what you see. Let me give you a very simplistic analogy. Today we look out into this audience and we see a range of hair color that ranges from blonde to white to black as molasses as midnight, as my grandmother would say. That range is extreme. Hair color is determined by so many different genes, by pigments, by regulation of pigments, by the very surface of the hair, that we can never tell you what would make a blonde person and what would make a dark-haired person. Hair color also is not so easily categorized. You cannot say somebody is necessarily blonde because they might be born as a towhead, but grow up to be brunette. Somebody who has black hair today might be gray tomorrow, or bald. Hair color is not a simple dichotomy. Something as simple as hair color being so complex, you would expect human behavior to be the same. It is of biological origin, but it is not necessarily the same in every individual. There will be individuals who will be innately and irretrievably heterosexual. There will be individuals who are innately and irretrievably homosexual. There will be individuals who are innately and irretrievably bisexual. And there will be individuals who can change. This is because even though something is of biological origin, it is always complex. Sorry, excuse me. I lost my place. In conclusion, I would like to say that the fact that sexual orientation is of biological origin in humans is highly relevant to the ongoing discussion of the Church's response to its homosexual brothers and sisters. Some in the Church would suggest that it is not. Orson Scott Card, a man who I respect and whose writings I love, unfortunately, Orson Scott Card's article, "The Hypocrites of Homosexuality," states, "The argument by the hypocrites of homosexuality that homosexual tendencies are genetically ingrained in some individuals is almost laughably irrelevant." It would be laughably irrelevant if the actions of the Church and its therapists in the past and continuing present hadn't made so solemnly relevant. It would be laughably irrelevant if the LDS Social Services and other church counselors hadn't put hundreds of men through tortuous electric shock and aversion therapies to change these children of God. Trying to maintain professional composure. It would be laughably irrelevant if it doesn't force hundreds of young men and women through years of fruitless and spiritually debilitating reparative counseling, and encourage thousands of men and women into marriages as therapy. I am here to say that it is highly relevant whether it is of biological origin or not. Using a simplistic notion, a false dichotomy, and then basing a therapy upon that can only hurt and not help the individuals and children of God. In an earlier talk by Melissa Wunderly about a totally unrelated subject, she said something that was very true for me. She said something that style is how we make it through this world and accomplish things in a world of unknowns. All I ask for LDS Social Services and the Church is that they realize this, that we are living in a world of 1,000 unknowns. We are in a world where things are never an either-or proposition, and that each individual is unique and needs to be treated as such. If the Church or Social Services does not do this, then they bring themselves to hurting the brothers and sisters, the children of God. Thank you.
an honor to be with these men today. And I also want to apologize for being late. I wish I could blame some really fun thing that I was doing at work, but it was really the planes and not me. I did have to work today. I also brought a lot of copies of the handbook that we're describing today. For those of you who haven't read it or seen it, I don't want any of you to doubt the truth of what we're saying about this document. And so it's here for your perusal and free of charge. You can come up afterwards. We stand here, Jeff, Trey, and I, with professional degrees and experience. We stand here humbly to speak from our hearts. We recognize that our message may be unpopular. We recognize the cost of criticizing an institution supported and financed by the church may be high. Yet we have not spoken militantly nor irrationally today. We have not come to debate the theological interpretation of homosexuality. But we have come to sound a warning, to tell you that men and women are dying, that families are being destroyed and torn apart, and the very professionals within these mental health organizations seem to have turned their backs on the role they play in causing continued suffering and pain. Jeff and Trey have spoken of broad ethical and scientific truths. I would like to close our presentation by bringing up the personal costs of these LDS-associated therapies and practices. I get very dry. I wish I could speak in a southern drawl. Two weeks ago, I sat in a small theater in Olympia, Washington, to view a documentary made by a non-Mormon graduate student from Utah. The film, which he titled Legacies, tells the story of four gay Mormons who had personal experience with LDS social services therapy. It was a powerful reminder that above all the rhetoric and theory about homosexuality are human beings struggling to understand the world they live in and what to do with their personal truths. The first person in this film was a friend of mine. He spoke of his experience at age 15, having confessed his homosexual orientation to his bishop and having been sent to BYU under the false pretense of going to a conference so that his parents wouldn't know that he was really going to visit therapist to be cured of his sexual orientation. Once there, the therapists explained their treatment plans to him. They would insert an IV into his arm, and while showing him male pornography, would inject a drug that would induce vomiting. This would be followed by heterosexual pornography and the injection of another drug to induce a euphoric state in him. This was done, mind you, without his parents' permission or knowledge. It was to be done repeatedly. When he failed to complete the treatment due to his own horror and discomfort, he had never even seen pornography before. He was sent home with a letter to his bishop describing his unwillingness to be cured. A letter shaming him for his unworthiness and his lack of faith. He was 15 years old. I think of my good friend who also at BYU confessed his homosexuality. He was the father of two children. He loved his wife and wanted to be cured, wanted to finally be rid of the sexual urges that seemed to be driving him from a normal family life. He was sent to a private LDS therapist in Provo, where for 8 months he would view homosexual pornography or discuss his sexual desires after taking a drug called Ipecac, a drug that induces vomiting. He went through 8 months of vomiting therapy and talks to this day of how much anger he holds over that treatment, for it did not remove or change his sexual desires. It just taught him to hate himself more. He goes on to tell about how he still believes that his therapist was as pained as he was during this therapy. But the therapist got paid to administer the torture. Despite history's evidence that such aversion therapy only serves to wound patients further rather than to cure them. As I've collected stories over the past few years of this and other treatment modalities offered to lesbian and gay Mormons, my horror has only deepened. There is a long history of these barbaric theories and practices. From the outside, it appears that if anyone allows for the possibility of other explanations or experiences in regards to homosexuality, they are banished to a symbolic Siberia within LDS social services and within the church. And as each new therapeutic modality replaces the old, there is no apology for or explanation of the previous therapy's failure. Even while this handbook, while acknowledging that these men and women do not choose their sexual orientation, it offers no apology for the years such claims did to damage those who came before. How can this be the case in a church that's dedicated to a search for truth? What are the costs for such experimentation with human souls? As a homosexual man who himself survived the very theories that we are discussing today, I can attest to the damage these have on vulnerable patients and their families. I personally have sat with an LDS social services therapist and been completely disbelieved when I did not fit into his definition of a homosexual or how I got this way. I did not know then how inappropriate he was in our interactions and the relationship. He was the professional then, but now I am forever sorry that this man holds a professional license and continues to serve vulnerable and hurting men and women and their families here in the state of Utah. The reparative therapies that LDS social services and other LDS associated counselors are practicing is about finding blame for one's sexual misdevelopment. It is not about healing. The treatment offered by social services is to further subdivide the patient's person into good and bad parts, to repress and overcome, to hate the bad parts. It is not about unifying and understanding. It is almost like they want to induce a schizoid state in their patients. A counselor is under a sacred obligation to validate the feelings, experience, and pain of the patient, and to enter the therapeutic relationship without a personal agenda other than assisting the patient to discover his or her own truths. They are to assist them to be completely honest with themselves and with the therapist. This relationship must be a safe place for honesty and discovery. Yet in practice, homosexual patients under the care of LDS social services must conform to a predefined stereotype and therapeutic plan or experience another failure. There is no room for complete honesty. There is very little room for confidentiality, since therapists often work in tandem with church leaders, sharing information back and forth. There is no safety in this, especially when one's membership rides on the outcome of a therapy, when one's standing at a church-sponsored school is placed in jeopardy if the therapy is not successful. LDS social services have responded to such criticism before with the argument that their patients want to change, that they are desperate to be cured. What the therapist is obligated to do in this instance is to address the dissonance and pain. There should be no divided loyalties in this relationship. The therapist is the professional. He or she should know the literature and the realities of the world in which they practice. The therapist is not to assist in causing further pain or setting the patient up for failure. The therapist is there to assist the patient tell their own story, to assist the patient in facing themselves honestly and without condemnation. Listening to the truth of someone's life is a privilege and an honor. When you tell someone your history, they should receive it as such. In practice, I experienced, and many men that I've talked to have described, how the social services therapist kept trying to get them to blame their fathers, to find fault with their mothers. I remember when my mother visited LDS social services with me. The therapist was most intent on eliciting information about my father and my parents' personal relationship. He wanted to know what sort of dysfunctions existed in my family. There were no answers as to why my brothers and sisters turned out heterosexual in the same family environment. Nor are there any such answers in the pages of Social Services and other LDS-associated publications. Even when the theory does not fit the reality of the family from which these men came, the therapist often uses that as evidence that the patient must be lying or hiding some fundamental truth that keeps them from discovering a way to be cured of their homosexuality. So if the patient can't blame his or her parents, then they are blamed for their lack of ability to be cured. The patient is in a no-win position. If they are not cured, they either are not willing to be cured or they lack the faith for the cure, another common accusation made by professionals and church leaders to those who do not succeed appropriately. Dean Bird, an administrator in LDS Social Services, said in a 1993 interview that reparative therapy is not about blaming parents, yet this handbook is nearly rabid in its attempts to blame the parents or dysfunctional family for the predicament these patients find themselves in. Parents of homosexuals carry an inordinate amount of guilt already. Many parents, especially mothers, have known since their children were very young that they were different. Many have tried for years to influence their children into more common social behaviors and attitudes. These children, often after years of prayer, secrecy, fasting, self-hatred, confusion, public condemnation, finally appear in a therapist's office, vulnerable, desperate for help, desperate for understanding. These parents, after years of fearing the worst, appear at the professional's offices desperate for answers and for assistance, desperate to find out where they went wrong, and desperate to find someone who will love and understand their child as much as they do. The handbook is all too willing to tell them that they did wrong, but offers no specific proof of this. It describes how parents who notice that their children are behaving in ways uncommon to general gender roles, i.e., and these are quotes, if their sons like ballet or dolls, or their daughters want to play with trucks, these children and their families must be found and brought into therapy. It has the gall to even say that this must happen before the age of 5. The handbook goes into ways of informing parents of their need to change and accept the responsibility for causing their sons and daughters to be such socially unacceptable people. This book is not a joke. Socially defined gender roles are written of as if they are gospel truths. Can you imagine all the trauma parents and children will go through if these suggestions? Can you imagine how this would be translated in other cultures? Can you imagine the witch hunt in our Mormon community if all the boys who play with dolls or like to dance are forced into therapy regarding their sexual development? Or if their fathers are confronted and labeled as poor fathers just because of their sons' recreational interests? Can you imagine the dynamics of such father-son relationships after that? Not to mention the sexism this has when looked at from a female perspective. The tomboys among us are suddenly going to be looked at more closely. Aggressive, strong women will have one more demerit in our Mormon culture. They will be labeled and damaged by the intense accusation that they might be lesbian. This in an era when we are realizing that we have socialized females inappropriately already. Even as I prepared for this presentation months after reading and reviewing the handbook, I found it unbelievable that my church could fund and then publish such rubbish. I find it unbelievable that I would, along with these friends, have to travel to Salt Lake to raise a warning voice to parents and church leaders that lunacy appears to have overtaken this respectable organization. Where are the honest and ethical medical and psychotherapy professionals in Utah? Why have they not arisen in shock and disbelief to these pathetic and dangerous ideas? Besides Dr. Gary Watts, the father of a gay son, no professional in the state of Utah seems to be caring. Why, in our most vulnerable and emotional states, are we being referred to men and women who have abandoned all reason and experience just to protect a theological theory? I have a lot of questions. Shirley Cox, who is an instructor of counseling at BYU, a therapist herself in the LDS social services system, and associated with Evergreen, was interviewed in March by the local press here in Salt Lake City regarding the flurry of issues that arose over the homosexual support clubs at East High. In that interview, she held out the party line as the only rational explanation for homosexuality. And then she promised startling results from a study in progress. A promise that she has the cure for homosexuality. Her response serves as very symbolic of the very criticism we are here to voice today. Her study was described as having 15 patients. She refused to explain more, nor did she give any details on who was included or excluded from her study. She did not acknowledge how such a small number of study participants could be representative of all those who are homosexual. She did not clarify study design or how it would be verified that these patients have indeed been changed, or if they continued to be changed once they leave the protected environment of her office. It sounded more like election year pandering for support than professional scientific honesty. We are standing here today because men and women are dying in our community. They are dying because there appears to be no safe place for them to be honest, no safe place for them to share their despair, no room for them to share their pain without the threat of excommunication or ostracization from their families, their community of faith, from the very life they have always dreamed of living. They are dying because of the pain they feel they are causing others. We are standing here today because men and women are being forced to remain silent to survive in this community. Many of these men and women are entering marriages with unsuspecting partners of the opposite sex, who thus become part of an experiment to prove that there is indeed some cure. These families, when they fall apart, carry unbelievable pain. Yet does anyone in authority care? The women who I have come to know over the past few years who have been married to homosexual men have so much anger and pain, and justifiably so. Yet, in many instances, these marriages continue to be applauded and encouraged by professionals and church leaders here in the Mormon community. We are standing here to support our families. They have been blamed inappropriately for long enough. It is time for the madness to end. It is time for healing. It is time for families to be supported and understood in all of their complexity. We are here because it is time for an honest dialogue. The LDS Church's mental health professionals, whether directly affiliated with social services or with their own society called AMCAP, have painted themselves into a corner where their own writings and therapy practices are putting themselves at odds with accepted professional ethical standards and endangering our brothers and sisters, your sons and daughters' lives. Their physical, spiritual, and mental well-being is at stake. These professionals have put all their credibility in with fringe elements in their profession who would rather publish wild accusations and myths than to design and publish the true experiences of their practices. They have painted all other information and experience as suspect, apostate, or worse, evil. We are here to warn the church and all who would listen that those affiliated therapists are not fulfilling their missions as mental health professionals are as saints. They have an agenda to direct their patients into one approved outcome. And those who do not conform, be damned. Too many of them are. As a gay Mormon, a professional, a father of two sons, and as a son of faithful Mormons and Mormon pioneers, I am standing here today to say it is time for honesty, for honest listening and honest discussion. We stand here individually today as your sons and warn you that enough families have been destroyed, enough suicides have occurred, enough marriages of convenience and faith have begun in dishonesty, and enough of those marriages have ended in divorce, leaving enough children struggling to understand the confusing, divided loyalties of their parents. Enough tears have been shed. We are standing here to ask for a hearing with the leaders of the church and LDS Social Services, a detente, if you will. We have all lost enough to warrant the consideration of such an offer. Thank you.
We are now to a point where we have about 10 minutes left in our formal session, and we'll devote that to questions and discussions. And what I would like to do is, if you have a relatively brief question, just ask it from where you are, and I will repeat it here for the tape. If you have a longer question or a comment to make, if you want to come up to the microphone, that would be better. Then I won't have to repeat it. And although we haven't provided paper and pencils for this purpose, it is perfectly acceptable to send a written question up if you want to write one out and send it up. I think Dr. Grossbeck has.
I have a comment and a question. Background. Thank you. Thank you. I have to tell where I'm coming from. Graduate of USC Medical School, 40 years in private practice, family practice, accent on office psychiatry. Back in the days when the services ferreted out the homosexual boys and girls and discharged them, the head of the OSI, where I was based, felt that was criminal. And he asked me to do a lengthy psychiatric interview on all the boys that he picked up and girls that he picked up to weed out the curious, the bisexuals, and then to try to undo the damage that the service was doing to these boys and girls by giving them a dishonorable discharge. That's my background. The question revolves around one patient. This girl was raised on an Ohio farm by her bachelor father and her widower father and three bachelor uncles. What would you say to her? My own feeling, of course, is that the LDS policy is barbaric, that the last person that a homosexual should go to is a bishop.
Great. I guess I'm the associating her family background of being raised with males and attributing that to her homosexuality is an association which I think would bear some exploration. You would find as well a woman who was raised with a mother and five aunts who may have the same homosexuality. So it's the attributing the homosexuality with the people that she was born with that I would first question. And I guess without knowing anything else about her, it would be hard to say anything specific other than studies have really not shown that particular family constellation is sufficient to cause or even closely causal of a homosexual orientation.
What should I have said to her?
What should he have said to her?
Did you want to say that one?
Oh, okay. Dr. Killian, try that one.
This is 40 years ago. You probably didn't have a lot of access to other information, but today we would probably tell her that we have no evidence that just from where you, because you came from a bunch of men and uncles, that you're going to be a lesbian. And then ask her how she feels about it. Why is it hurting her? Has she tried to overcome it? Change? And, you know, sort of explore with her.
I really didn't know what to think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I do as a physician, I'm a family physician as well, and I spent several months extra in my residency learning psychotherapy and counseling. I tell my patients, I first validate their experience and their feelings and tell them that they're not bad. And I try to get away. I try to talk about not being bad and putting moral judgments on our behavior or our feelings, and then sort of going from there with them. But nowadays there are a lot of writings and books and other materials in the media, movies, tapes, stories to share with people that are struggling.
Yeah.
Dr. Wallace says that one psychiatrist said they were just people with problems. Let's go on and see if we can get a couple of more questions. John Charles, you have... The question is to Dr. Jensen, what's the relationship between LDS Social Services and its professionals and APA, for example, the American Psychiatric Association?
It's a tough association. I mean, I have tried. I called Clinton Black, who is the who was associated with the American Psychological Association. I've talked with Robert Shabai, who is also the gay and lesbian liaison with the American Psychiatric Association. Because LDS Social Services is associated with Brigham Young University, which is a religious organization, they have much more leeway in what they teach to their people. Different credentialing procedures for the religious institutions compared to state-sponsored or state-owned institutions. They are interested in collecting stories of what is going on in order to make a case about these particular treatments. But as far as credentialing, all we can say is that they are going against professional ethics guidelines, and I am personally waiting for a lawsuit. That has not happened yet, which has proven damage. A lot of that is because when someone commits suicide, it's hushed up. It's homosexual. We don't talk about homosexuals who commit suicide because it's a family secret that we don't want anyone to know about. So no lawsuits have been raised. I'm waiting for that to happen, and I think eventually that'll happen, and that, I hope, will put some, at least motivate some people who are doing unethical procedures to reevaluate their practices.
Another question right here. Question is, in respect to Dr. Killian's challenge at the end of his talk for a discussion and a possible detente, have you already communicated that, or do you intend to communicate it other than by speaking here today?
We hope to publish both Trey and Jeff's extended papers and a collection of stories, and thus work our way in that way. From what I understand, those of my friends who have met with Dr. Bird, he's been fairly resistant to hearing anything else other than what he has to say and what he's publishing. So this was the only forum that we could find in Utah where we could get some public exposure to this. It's also fairly unique for professionals in the state of Utah to out themselves and to stand without fear and ask for truth and honesty here in the state. So it's fun to be here today.
Anybody else? Over here, please. The question is whether Church Social Services wrote this document or plagiarized it.
As you can tell from just the few quotes that Rob and Trey and I quoted from this document, it really looks like the authors were undergraduate students doing some kind of research. I mean, it really is very poorly written, and in many ways, it's plagiarizing antiquated concepts, which really have no basis in today's society. And it's not only doing